I want to introduce Kate Doherty. Kate is from the Sydney branch of Socialist Alternative. She's a public servant and active in the public sector union there in New South Wales. She's going to be talking to us today about the Russian oligarchs and Putin. So give her your attention and we'll have some discussion when she's finished her talk. Thanks.
I'm afraid we no longer have oligarchs. That was a concept of the 90s. Nowadays, we have good, hard-working businessmen who care about their country and earn money through responsible means. That was Russia's deputy PM when asked about the recent US blacklist of influential Russians. And they sure must be hard-working because, in total, Russia's 96 billionaires are now worth a combined $386 billion, according to Forbes' 2017 World Billionaires list. Russian billionaires are worth actually $104 billion more than they were the year before, thanks to the recovery of commodity markets and an increase in the value of the Russian currency. And some of the most widely known Russian billionaires, I think, are those who own like Premier League football clubs, including Roman Abramovich, who owns this yacht, Alisher Usmanov, who owns part of Arsenal, or Russia's richest person, Leonid Mikhelson, who is a gas and chemicals magnate. And while Russian billionaires' wealth is rising, approximately 20 million Russians, 13% or more of the population, now officially subsist below the poverty line. A recent report found that 41% of Russians say that they struggle to get enough money together for food and clothing, and there are more traditional healers than registered doctors in Russia, just showing the degradation of their health system. So 101 years on from the Russian Revolution, which toppled the Tsar's centuries of authoritarian rule, Russia is beset by a born-to-rule class of parasites who enrich themselves at the cost of millions of poor Russians. And modern-day oligarchs still look fondly on the Tsarist era. So, like, this classy chap, Sergei Veremenko, who literally hangs a bearskin and a portrait of Tsar Nicholas II side by side in his hunting lodge. And I think this makes sense, actually, for the oligarchs. The time of the Tsar's rule was seen as a golden era for the Russian Empire and people like them. So there are various features of Putin and the oligarchs and this current time that are shared with Tsarist rule, particularly extreme wealth inequality, brutal imperialism and authoritarianism. So just to give, I know inequality stats are always a little bit complex because you've got self-reporting basically of wealth, but it just gives an idea that Russia is definitely up there with the most unequal societies on the planet. Couple of caveats. I mean, I don't speak Russian, so I'm going to give the pronunciation my best shot, and I'm not going to focus that much on current affairs because I want to give more of an overview of the key political and economic dynamics and touch on some of the key things that are happening in the world, though. So particularly I want to consider how today's Russia really came out of Soviet society. I want to give a quick outline of the key periods of economic and political development since the USSR collapsed, and then I want to move on to a bit more discussion on Russian imperialism and the specific authoritarian style of Putin's government. So I think that the fundamental features of capitalism don't change just because you cross a border into Russia, like class division and exploitation, production for profit, competition. These are all like fundamental features of the Russian system just as they are of world capitalism. And yet the ruling class have a degree of flexibility in how they run capitalism within particular states. They can have more or less freedoms or restrictions, differing models of exploitation and parliamentary democracy, dictatorship and so on. And I think much of the structure and peculiarities of the Russian system today has its roots in the history of the Soviet era. So Tony Wood described that the new post-Soviet Russia was not built on a blank slate. It emerged from within the carapace of the USSR, inheriting many of the preceding order's peculiarities, transforming them or exaggerating them into new shapes. And Soviet Russia was built on a bureaucratic dictatorship, which cloaked itself in communist rhetoric, but it was still vastly unequal, undemocratic, and had nothing in common with the revolutionary aims of the workers who rose up in 1917. And after World War II, the Cold War further deformed the Soviet economy with that enormous arms spending, prioritising heavy industry and leaving whole areas of the economy behind. And from 1987, this structural crisis led to increasing unrest. Under the pressure of protests, mass strikes, demonstrations, the regimes fell one by one, and so that map that I showed before was pulled apart. Revolutions involved millions of people and swept throughout countries which had been presumed to be unassailable police states in a display of working class power. Unfortunately, the alternative to communist dictatorship was offered by Boris Yeltsin, who spruiked westernisation and was elected as the first president of the Russian Federation. But behind the talk of Western freedoms was the reality. Neoliberal shock treatment was the prescription, and Yeltsin administered it. And the socialised elements of the old system were really consciously destroyed. However, key state institutions survived: the bureaucracy, the military, the secret police. And this period gave the Soviet elite, who had already controlled the means of production under the USSR, the chance to convert their power into actual direct property ownership. So the Russian state under Yeltsin really intervened decisively to ensure this outcome by rigging the process of privatisation of the state. And I think while many commentators claimed this was a transformation of a non-capitalist state into a capitalist one, I would actually argue there is no real creation of a new class. In fact, you're seeing many of the same people known in the USSR as the nomenklatura, and they're continuing to control industry in the state. Now, this didn't work out for every part of the old ruling class. Some did better than others, but those who rose extracted enormous amounts of capital from the country. And while this process was enormously profitable for a portion of the ruling class, it massively destabilised the Russian economy. So oil production collapsed from $12 million per day in the 80s to just over 6 million barrels per day in 98. GDP contracted by 34% between 91 and 95. Average real wages dropped by half. And I think there shouldn't be any nostalgia for the USSR, but it's important to understand that that collapse of the Soviet bloc and the privatisation program that followed was an economic and social catastrophe for the majority of the population. And this period after 1991 is sometimes known as that unmaking. It's like a ripping apart of the old social Soviet fabric that kind of ensured people's housing and social services through their employment. So with a rise in unemployment, deindustrialisation, this was all pulled apart. And many who did have jobs were unpaid for months or years. Second jobs, petty trade, all of this became commonplace, and life expectancy actually dropped by 5 years for men in that period. So in this unstable system, the short-term focus on profit for capitalists was heightened. And I think Ruslav goes through quite well in his book, The Conundrum of Russian Capitalism, like how raiding, hostile takeovers, these kind of things were quite common. And it leads to this real instability of ownership and control of corporations in Russia. And the ruling class basically tended to focus a lot more, therefore, on insider rent. So it's basically like extracting profits and funneling them offshore rather than reinvesting in capital. So it was massive capital flight in throughout the Yeltsin era, about $1 to $2 billion per month is the estimate. And it also stunts the medium and long-term growth of Russian capitalism. So really strong focus on the financial sector, get-rich-quick schemes, the non-productive sectors of the economy. And it also means that the structural crisis in the Soviet economy was not addressed by the transition to free market capitalism. So in 1998, the Russian ruble collapsed in value and Russia defaulted on its international debt. And I think this was the start of a bit of a new period in Russian capitalism. So for those with any savings, their value disappeared overnight. But for the capitalist class, it also basically forced investment away from the financial sector and into resource extraction and industry. And Putin came to power as the anointed heir of Yeltsin, basically on the eve of the year 2000, with the backing of key oligarchs. And he had a bit of an extraordinary stroke of luck in one way, because the increase in global commodity prices, which was spurred on by China's rise, combined with those changing investments that were encouraged by the ruble collapse, just brought the Russian economy really back to life. Oil jumped from $10 a barrel in 99 to $75 a barrel in 2006. And it kind of brought a different set of oligarchs really to the fore, those in extractive industries, hydrocarbon, steel and aluminium and so on. And the economic rebound after 98 also laid that basis for a recovery of state capacity, which enabled a much strengthened executive to forge a consensus with the elite on its own terms. It's said that in 2000, Putin struck a deal with 21 key oligarchs, basically to leave the economic deals of the 1990s untouched if they would stay out of politics. And I think the Western media dramatised this as this question about, like, Putin's personality, his history as a KGB agent and so on. But I think it's actually better explained as a strategic decision for Russian capitalism. Like, a degree of separation between capital and government has its benefits for their side. The capitalist state has, like, a pretense of independence. There's greater capacity for strategy for Russian capitalism overall. And I think that state ownership in the key sectors really provided important income to address the hollowing out of the state that happened under Yeltsin. So some glamorise Putin's supposed toughness on Russia's rich, and it's true that there are certainly oligarchs who've been punished for stepping out of line. For example, someone like Khodorkovsky publicly challenged Putin, started a nationwide campaign for democracy, bought media companies and so on. And he was arrested in 2003. He had his company assets seized and transferred to a state company. And he spent a decade in jail before negotiating a release on a condition of exile. But I don't think that this is generalised. Things are not tough for the oligarchs under Putin. Actually, that process of elite super-enrichment that started in the 90s carried on into the 2000s. And Putin instituted a number of big structural benefits for the super-rich. So a 13% flat tax rate, a new labour code which benefited employers, attacking public housing services. And these reforms kind of brought back mass protest onto the scene for the first time since the USSR collapsed. So just to show that the oligarchs weren't doing too badly, for example, in 2013, the 24-year-old daughter of a Russian oligarch bought this private Greek island, Skorpios, for $153 million. And her father was said to have $9.1 billion at the time. So I'll just say that, like, with the global financial crisis in 2008, Russia's stock market absolutely crashed. It lost 3/4 of its value. And their contraction with this crisis was the biggest out of the G20. So they went from 8% growth to negative 8%. After some improvement in living standards and incomes that had happened through that preceding period, deprivation really returned on a big scale. Like, petty trading, second jobs, unpaid wages, all of that from the 90s reappeared. And the Kremlin decided on a massive bailout, but a portion of it went to social spending, pensions, unemployment benefits, increase in state sector wages, no coincidence, all three crucial voting bases of Putin. But also, I would say that big business bailouts were really the main focus, and proportionally the Russian bailout was double that of Obama's. So I want to move on to discuss Russian imperialism and Putin's government, which, of course, they're shaped by these changing economic circumstances. Now, if you read the mainstream media, you could be mistaken for thinking that Russia is so exceptional. Like, it's a sham democracy with corruption, human rights abuses, authoritarian practices, crass indulgence of the rich. And I would say every single one of those is a feature of Russia's political and economic landscape, and it's sickening. but actually the Western finger pointers are really residing in Trump's America, or the Britain of Grenfell Tower, or the Australian Gulag Archipelago, and they don't look at the mass injustices in their own corners of the world in the same light. But I think it's right to understand, like, where Russia fits within the world to understand Russian imperialism. So I'll just quote from the International Socialist Journal from the UK. They say, the newfound assertiveness is what really disturbed the West, not the increasing authoritarianism of the Putin leadership, which is common to other states committed to one aspect or another of the war on terror. This new assertiveness is not simply a product of the Russian oil boom, which supplied a means but not a motivation, much less some innate national propensity for aggression against non-Russians. It's a threat from the West which galvanised the Russian leadership following the fragmentation and infighting of the Boris Yeltsin years. And I think it's absolutely true that the US and EU, through NATO, took the opportunity of the Yeltsin years to encroach substantially in former Eastern Bloc territories. They saw that as an opportunity to take back. And Russia, under Putin, then has been increasingly assertive. So they've used a combination of military and economic influence, invading a range of countries which had been part of the USSR, Chechnya, Georgia, Crimea, Ukraine and others. And I think there is absolutely no doubt about the brutality of Russian imperialism, which makes the campism of some elements of the left even more preposterous and unforgivable. Like, the raising of the Chechen capital, Grozny, in 99 and 2000 involved Scud missiles, thermobaric bombs, cluster munitions. It actually left the city declared the most destroyed city on Earth by the UN. And photos of Grozny basically are the precursor to those of Homs, of Aleppo and of Ghouta. The justification is really familiar. You know, the US trot out exactly the same stories and they're all imperialist butchers. They said, so the Russians would say, that Chechnya and Syria, where they're bombing civilian neighbourhoods, they claim to be destroying terrorist targets. And a Russian MP boasted in the Duma that as we helped the brotherly Syrian people, we tested over 200 new types of weapons. They've been so successful in this slaughter that it helped to secure many contracts to export those weapons elsewhere. Now, economically, Russia is a bit of a middling power, but its substantial nuclear arsenal, together with its size and position, increase its geostrategic significance. And its involvement in Syria was a bit of a step out of its backyard militarily. Now, the US is definitely the single biggest economic and military power, but there are fundamental disagreements within the US ruling class on imperial strategy and how to respond to the changing balance of forces. So if you look at basically what Trump is saying in the public space, I think that the Trump White House wants to build the relationship with Russia to enable it to focus on China. That's something that Obama's pivot to Asia failed to accomplish. And it isn't hard to see on my pretty poor graph which country is the main international competitor based on GDP. So if that strategy requires turning a blind eye to Russian intervention in Ukraine, anti-democratic processes and so on, that is a price that Trump is willing to pay. And I think while Trump supports a rapprochement of sorts, many key players in the American state, like important Republicans and the Democratic Party, are against any thawing of relations with Russia. So that disagreement on strategy in the US has been really playing out through the election hacking scandal, the sanctions discussions and so on. And the hacking scandal has quite effectively constrained Trump's positioning on Russia. It's enabled also the Democrats to completely ignore their primary reasons why their Wall Street-loving warmonger Clinton was beaten by the most unpopular presidential candidate ever. And just briefly on the hacking, I think we can say that, look, it's generally uncool when governments screw with the limited democratic processes that ordinary people are entitled to under capitalism, but The failures of US democracy go far beyond some online trolls, email leaks, advertising organised by the Russians. And the US is no stranger to meddling in elections, violently or otherwise, literally in tens of countries. So, for example, in 96, Boris Yeltsin, the pro-West candidate, was polling in fifth place, 8% of the vote he had at that time. And he'd been responsible for the economic catastrophe, and basically it looked like the Communist Party candidate might win. So the US were totally happy to ignore Yeltsin's blatant flouting of electoral rules helped by various oligarchs. They pushed the IMF to release a $10.2 billion emergency infusion to Russia, and that was enough to turn things around and actually secure Yeltsin's second term. So US sanctions legislation that were passed in August 2017 were signed into law by Trump, but I would say probably under a fair bit of pressure from the bureaucracy. There were no tweets, no big press conferences with enormous signature and so on. And like in January 2018, there was a Treasury report prepared under that legislation that named individuals from Russia who were closely affiliated with the Russian government. But the list indiscriminately lists all of the 96 Forbes-listed billionaires. So Foreign Policy Magazine and commentators on the US state are like all outraged that the Trump government are kind of subverting the proper intention of that legislation. And there's also 114 state government or state company heads and government officials, with the exception of Putin, who are also listed. But as yet, no new sanctions have actually been legislated. And there's manoeuvring from both sides within Congress, within like Trump's team, on who's going to force who, to whether or not they will act on the legislation and institute sanctions. But nonetheless, it's still set a cat amongst the pigeons, and a lot of those who were listed did seek urgent legal advice in the US about this whole situation. And I think this White House advisor to Clinton and Bush kind of represents that more mainstream establishment position on this question. He said, in their anxiety, I sense leverage and opportunity to make a point. And that point is that Putin's aggression has consequences against Russia's elite. I think we can just say that with the gradual shift of the tectonic plates of kind of the world's economic and military powers, escalations of these various conflicts and strategic differences will really continue to play out. And we'll just have to watch this space. But finally, I wanted to discuss Putin's government, because I think his style is generally kind of as a conservative populism. It's the brand of like a strongman leader with traditional values who stands at the head of a besieged nation under attack from the West. And I mean, he joked, for example, that it was really offensive that he hadn't personally been put on the sanctions list. But then he said, in effect, all 146 million of us Russians have been put on some list in an indisputably unfriendly act. Now, civil rights are pretty much dispensed with out of hand in Russia in a way that I think quite a few Western leaders might dream of. They viciously attack LGBTI rights. That caused a lot of controversy at the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics, if people recall. Things like the arrest of the Pussy Riot protesters. That was a major focal point in the Western news, apparently less so in Russia, but it shows a kind of modus operandi. And I would say that the exile and murder of government critics is it's an ongoing phenomenon. Now, Trump made fun of liberals' concerns that Putin was a killer. So he was brutally honest. He said, there are a lot of killers. We have a lot of killers. Well, you think our country is so innocent? And yet, I think Putin's record of violence is nothing to be sneezed at. Like, high-profile critics of and journalists and so on routinely meet an untimely end, and it goes uninvestigated. So a few examples of high-profile murders while Putin was president, like journalist and key critic of the government's brutal slaughter in Chechnya, that was Anna Politkovskaya, in 2005, or opposition politician Boris Nemtsov in 2015. I think really, we shouldn't have any delusion that there's some kind of left content to Putin's government. It's utterly misplaced. It's authoritarian, it's neoliberal, it's imperialist. And under Putin, really, there's been a rise in nationalist gangs who physically attack, like brutally attack migrants. That's gone completely unchecked by the Russian state, as it has in many countries. And I think that is fed by government rhetoric on terrorism and immigration. And the Kremlin under Putin has created various youth organisations. So one was called Nashi, combined traditional values, extreme patriotism, paramilitary skills and far-right flourishes. It actually had hundreds and thousands of members at one time. But it was basically disbanded or not funded anymore after it appeared ineffective in the face of mass anti-government protests in 2011 and 12. And there's now like a new, slicker youth propaganda group called Network. That's the newest version, and it's genuine Putin worship, like if you check out their website. So with his success in this year's election, Putin is set to be like president or prime minister of Russia for a full quarter century through to 2024. And he has really administered the country through this type of managed democracy. There's a facade of some democratic institutions, but real control is based in the presidential administration. And I don't think that completely tells us that Putin's support is just fabricated. So the population of Russia had experienced like two massive Great Depression-style crises within a decade. And Putin's regime promised some level of stability. It was brutal, but it seemed less terrible, I think, than the starvation alternative for many. And there was no real political opposition. So in the 2000s, it even kind of seemed that Putin had the cure for Russia's economic woes. Now, Putin was appointed acting president by Yeltsin and with the blessing of those key oligarchs. And when he won the presidential elections in 2000 and 2004, it was with quite strong votes and in a strong economic climate. Now, as Russia has this, like, a constitutional limit of two consecutive terms of president, Putin appointed the Prime Minister Medvedev in 2005, and they effectively swapped roles in 2008. Medvedev won the presidential election and appointed Putin PM. And after that point in time, you really had the financial crisis shaking that concept of stable government and this mass popularity of Putin. Because in the 2011 Duma like parliamentary elections, polls were actually suggesting that Putin and Medvedev in the United Russia Party were losing support and may actually lose the elections altogether. So the vote rigging that followed to keep United Russia as the parliamentary majority was blatant and incompetent in the extreme. So there was ballot stuffing in some areas where United Russia's vote exceeded 100% of the actual vote. And in one locality, 146%, which challenged even Stalin's own history of absurd vote rigging. So that blatant disregard for even that facade of democracy, it really struck a nerve. Protests of up to 100,000 were held in response, and there was resistance that continued from like late 2011 on well into 2012. But in May 2012, a severe government crackdown occurred. They were actually still arresting protesters in 2015 for offences supposedly committed in that 2012 rally. And I'd say that not only is vote rigging an ongoing phenomenon, but the Kremlin actually substantially controls the opposition parties, or the opposition parties are kind of complicit or accept Putin's role. So they even run kind of candidates to try and split potentially problematic sections of any opposition vote that they would get and so on. For example, one supposedly liberal candidate, Ksenia Sobchak, who ran on things like LGBTI rights and so on, but with a neoliberal economic program. She's the daughter of a close colleague of Putin. And the Communist Party ran a millionaire candidate. And despite claiming to be left-wing, that party are not only Stalinist, but they're homophobic, anti-Semitic, and seriously nationalist, like anti-immigration. The one candidate that appeared as a somewhat genuine opposition, Alexei Navalny, was actually barred from running at all due to questionable kind of legal charges. And Navalny isn't really a left alternative, but his persecution by the government has given him a real radical gloss. And rightly, he does point out that the elections are a sham. He produces videos critiquing corruption and so on. So it's kind of understandable that a whole lot of people support him. He got over 200,000 volunteering for his campaign, and they also turned out to protest in fairly substantial numbers in his name. Now, the small Russian left participated in protests, like calling for a boycott of the elections. And the Russian state were really brutal in their repression. Like, volunteers for his campaign were actually arrested, had their houses searched, and so on. I think another symptom of the nervousness around Putin's so-called, like, you know, invincible popularity is actually that he announced last year that he would run as an independent candidate in this election. So that would split him off from the United Russia Party, which he'd spent most of his political life at the head of. And United Russia holds the majority of seats in the Duma, and I think that it might be an attempt to kind of channel discontent towards that party rather than Putin himself. And also, despite that, actually, most of his election campaign funding came from United Russia, but through affiliated organisations around the back channels. And there's some other things to try and manage their falling popularity. I think Putin's government also moved the Duma elections forward into 2016 and moved the presidential elections back to try and disconnect those events. They did not want a rerun of 2011-2012. And really, you can kind of understand why, because when they looked at the 2016 election turnout, it actually had fallen more than 12% from 2011. So it was down to 48% of people coming out to vote. And in Moscow and St. Petersburg, less than 30% of people voted. So I think that gives the context for the Kremlin's real focus on turnout in the presidential election. I'd say that there's a tension between, like, you know, Putin speaks a bit about addressing poverty, improving healthcare and that kind of stuff, but there's this real tension also with defence spending, like police and security spending, which make up around a third of their government spending. And really the bigger focus of his campaign and the kind of way his populist angle is on nationalism. So I think that's the central pillar of his campaign. The slogan was Strong President, Strong Russia. And they moved the election to the anniversary of the annexation of Crimea. So you've got this change in the economic situation, which I think as it's actually squeezing the Kremlin's space for manoeuvre. So there's declining revenues, but also a block on opportunities for Russian banks to refinance in the West. And so their previous strategy of kind of plugging holes in the economy using like big government reserves is really exhausted. And it makes it more difficult for the Russian state to come up with these payments for pensioners or state sector employees at strategic times. So that's part of their key voter base. Now, I don't think there was any real risk of Putin losing the election, but turnout was the big focus. So they actually ran these really disgusting ads on the TV. This is like a snapshot from a super homophobic ad that they ran. It was like basically a dystopian nightmare where gay people would be put into your house if Putin lost the election and other terrible things happen. But it's just a sign. Of course, the government don't actually put their byline on the advertising, but it was slick and well-financed and obviously from the Kremlin in some way. And I would say that, like, preceding the election, there was actually months of intense pressure from the Kremlin on regional governors to get Putin at least 70% of the vote and 70% turnout to the election. So just to give an idea of how much effort they put in to getting these numbers. Like, Golos, which is Russia's main independent election monitoring group, noted a range of irregularities. Ballot stuffing, the purging of 2 million dead souls from the roll, which some of whom were still alive, but it boosts the turnout percentage. absentee voting enabled was introduced for this election, and it enabled multiple votes, so you could travel around and vote in various places. There were several regions with a perfect 70% turnout, or very round number supporting Putin. And also there was like widespread instances recorded of civil servants, big employers, staff, soldiers, students being bussed or herded to voting centres. So I think that figure of 80% popularity for Putin is a bit of a passive support, if it's true at all. There's really no opposition to cohere any dissatisfaction, and I think it's true that actually a lot of Russians may have a nationalist pride in the annexation of Crimea, for example, but then they're let down by poor health and education services and a whole range of other things. So Yevgeny, a 43-year-old mechanic voting in central Moscow, said when interviewed, he briefly wondered whether it was worth voting, but the answer is easy. If I want to keep working, I vote. And they even scheduled like parent-teacher conferences at schools on the Sunday of the vote, and all these things. So obviously, like, yeah, it was a big effort, and they managed to get 67.5% turnout. But 76% of those who voted for Putin. So it was actually a new record, over 56 million votes for Putin, including the new 1.2 million from Crimea, which has been added to the voting roll. So I just wanted to say, to stand at the head of this, there's a whole lot of authoritarianism going on with the regime. And just a couple of the kind of things to point out. Like in 2014, new laws criminalised street protests with 5 years in jail, even if they were like peaceful protests. The election of mayors has been abolished, so there's this direct appointing of local political elites, which is actually quite useful when you think they're putting pressure on to get the votes out in all these areas. It's good to have loyal people in place. But I think all of this has its own overheads, and it may kind of add fuel to the fire once resistance does begin. So just quickly on the left, there's been isolated labour disputes, which actually are increasing, but so far they really haven't broken out to the industry or nationwide level. The workers' movement faces political problems. There's kind of co-option, a history of like cooperation with the Stalinist regime, and now allying themselves with the Putin regime, and also cooperating with bosses in a big way. And then there's like a history of the free trade unions, which sprung up in the 1980s and 1990s, which went from organising actual like rank and file strikes to relying on Western funding and looking to the market as some kind of alternative. So there have been a few more radical unions with class struggle politics, such as in the car industry about a decade ago, but the Russian state dissolved them and they were kind of isolated without much solidarity. So the Stalinist history of Russia really distorts the conception of left-wing organisations, I think. And a lot of them either sugarcoat the history of Stalinist dictatorship or they look to the West and say, like, freedoms and Western democracy are the way forward. So all attempts to develop, like, a bigger left-wing party to represent workers have failed up to this point. There are a few small Trotskyist and anarchist groups with some support among the youth in major cities. But the periodic flare-ups, I think, of mass protest through the Putin era just show there's still that underlying potential of the working class. So, very quickly to conclude, this history has really been punctuated by crises. You've got the collapse of the USSR, the 98 collapse of the ruble, and the global financial crisis in quick succession. And it shows neither state capitalism nor free market capitalism can solve that tendency towards deep and recurring crises. Chris Harman described that transition as like jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. And I would say that just as in the time of the SARS, the Russian ruling class today is really still experiencing that tendency of capitalism to go into crisis. These photos are from a photojournalism essay about the oligarchs and their help. And I think that it just shows, like, many of those same contradictions are at play. So they enrich themselves out of the suffering of the mass of the population. And also they're both unwilling and unable to address the systemic weaknesses of their economic and political system. So the excesses of the ruling class really serve to just underscore the deprivations of the working class. So I'm not predicting a rerun of the Russian Revolution commencing tomorrow, but I think any serious analysis of the Russian political and economic situation shows a series of weaknesses in the Russian economy. Falling living standards, insufficient social spending, a defence budget that's stretching past capacity, and increasing tensions in that world system. And the extent of Putin's personal power and the focus on him as a personality, I think it's a weakness for Russia's ruling class, because without another change to the law, Putin can't run again in 2024. And there's all of these debates happening within the Kremlin now around Russia without Putin. That's all just beginning. So in 1916, the Tsarina confidently stated in a letter to Tsar Nicholas II, "Russia loves to feel the whip. It's their nature, tender love, and then the iron hand to punish and guide." And I think while Putin's combination of national pride and authoritarianism now seems to keep resistance at bay, I'd suggest it's likely to bear a bit of fruit. The working class is objectively more massive and potentially powerful one century on. And the current day Tsars of Putin and the oligarchs deserve to be overthrown with just as much vigour as the Romanovs were in 1917.